Coming up is the news.
Palestinian inmates begin a hunger strike in protest at an escalation in Israeli violations in prisons. The detainees say this strike will go on for 2 weeks. Iran says that the U.S. foot-dragging is to blame for the current limbo on the 2015 nuclear deal. Tehran says Washington needs to make a political decision on the issue. The U.S. and South Korea begin their largest combined military drill since 2018 in a dramatic escalation of tensions on the Korean Peninsula. This is World News, broadcast from your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Palestinian prisoners resuming mass hunger strike action to protest mistreatment in Israeli jails. The detainees say that a two-week action also aims to protest repeated inspection of their cells. The inmates say that Israel's actions violates its March agreement with the Palestinian Commission of Detainees Affair. The agreement ended the previous mass hunger strike by thousands of Palestinian prisoners. The commission says it will not discourage the prisoners from claiming their rights, and it's ready to confront any violation by the Israeli prison service. In the meantime, the top Israeli court has rejected an appeal for the release of a Palestinian prisoner who's been in hunger strike for 172 days. According to Khalil Awada's lawyer, the court turned down the request and affirmed the decision to freeze his administrative detention. Awada was supposed to be freed on September 15th. The court denied the request after Israel's internal spy agency, Shin Bet, handed over a confidential file to the judge. The Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad has also demanded his release as part of a ceasefire that ended three-day Israeli aggression on Gaza early this month. Awada has been on hunger strike since March 4th to protest his administrative detention, a policy that Tel Aviv follows, to indefinitely imprison Palestinians without any charge or trial. Iran says the United States is to blame for a delay in an agreement on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says that Washington is dragging its feet to give a response to the draft text proposed by the EU. Kanani says that Iran responded to the EU's proposal in a constructive way and has shown enough flexibility. But it says that a few very important issues remain to be addressed. The spokesman says the United States is responsible for the current situation and needs to show real will to restore the nuclear accord. Tehran submitted its response to the EU's proposal a week ago. The U.S., however, says it is still studying Iran's response. Political commentator Mustafa Khoshchev says it's the West and the Europe in particular that will suffer in case a deal to revive the JCPOA is not reached.
The Americans have apparently not provided a fully yes answer. When they sent their reply to the EU, Mora would immediately send that positive reply to Iran. I don't know if they would say, something half and half or something like no. But it's to their detriment. It's to their loss. You know, Europe is now grappling with the outcomes of the Ukraine war and rising energy prices. In about a couple of weeks, three, 4 weeks from now, when pre-fall or pre-cold season oil purchases start, the prices would rise. And even if American released more of their strategic reserves, again, prices would rise because as it lowers, the U.S. strategic reserves, it leaves a negative impact on the market and the prices start to rise. Right now, we are seeing the introductory or preliminary signs of this problem in Europe. Europe is paying a higher price for lack of energy and energy prices, rising energy prices, and in future, in the cold season, they would pay more. So Americans know it, Europeans know it. If they were really logical, I mean, especially the Americans, they would take whatever they could right now and give Iran a positive answer. Because in about a few weeks' time, they will, I mean, those nations in the West, the United States and especially Europe, they would pay a higher price, and the leverage on them would be heavier. This is no secret.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is calling for an immediate release of Iranian national Hamid Nouri. He's been handed a life sentence by a Swedish court. Amir Abdollahian described as unacceptable the court's process of trial and verdict. He says Nouri should enjoy basic rights, including medical access and the right to contact his family. The top diplomats made those comments in a meeting with a Swedish ambassador to Tehran. Nouri was detained in Sweden in 2019. He was sentenced life over the alleged rights violations against members of an anti-Iran terror group in the 1980s. Tehran has already called the charge against Nouri baseless and fabricated. The MKO was infamous for plotting assassinations and killing hundreds of Iranians since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. News review time. Stay tuned. The U.S. and South Korea have started their biggest combined drill since 2018, a move that's likely to draw angry reactions from North Korea. The exercises will be running for 10 days. They include large-scale field training, abandoned under the previous South Korean administration to make room for peace. More details are yet to be released. Such war games have involved deployment of aircraft, warships and tanks, and tens of thousands of troops in the past. South Korea and the U.S. state as such drills are purely defensive, but North Korea deems them as a rehearsal for invasion. The maneuvers have also pushed Pyongyang to fire a blitz of missiles this year. They include the first launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile since 2017. I'm now inviting two guests to get some more information on this and discuss that a little bit. So our correspondent, Jennifer Chang, is joining me from Seoul. Also with us is Andrew Leung. He's a political analyst in Hong Kong. Good to see you. Now, beginning with Jennifer, as you know, this is what Pyongyang has always objected to and has made it clear that this is provocation. It's the war games and all that. Still, South Korea and the U.S. are holding such drills and at such a larger scale this time.
Yes. In fact, the South Korean president, Seo-yeol, and he's ultra-conservative and a tremendous hardliner against the North. He is introducing the drills in the field for the first time in 5 years, which are aimed ultimately at decapitating the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. And of course, they are going to try to take out the nuclear and missile facilities in the North. But after that, the climax is this assassination of the North Korean leadership, or decapitation, as it's called. Mm-hmm. And this is drawing controversy because the North has so many tactical nukes and nuclear weapons and missiles, precision missiles, all kinds of weapons now. This is a different game now from 2016 when this decapitation strategy was first introduced by South Korea under former President Park Geun-hye following North Korea's fifth nuclear test in September 2016. Since then, the North has really passed major milestones in its nuclear weapons development and other weapons development. So right now, this strategy of just removing Pyongyang from the map with South Korean precision missiles is not going to work, say many analysts, and it's dangerous. And even U.S. analysts are saying this now, that the extended deterrence that South Korea is envisioning under the new president is too punishment-oriented, even for the U.S., because if indeed this becomes reality through some sort of miscalculation, and some sort of a preemptive strike and attempt to assassinate the North Korean leader by South Korea and the U.S. takes place, that increases the chances that North Korean missiles will fall on the U.S. mainland. The North now has the capability, according to many experts, of conducting a nuclear strike on the U.S. mainland with a nuclear-tipped ICBM.
Okay, now let me ask Andrew what he thinks about this, because, you know, Pyongyang will definitely not sit idle by like previous times. In return, they will conduct more tests, and God knows what kind of tests, if bigger ones than the ballistic ones, I don't know. So we have the two sides taking these tit-for-tat measures. What will be the result at the end of the day, Andrew? Will there be a nuclear bombing, like Jennifer said, by North Korea against U.S. mainland, or what?
Well, this is definitely an escalation, a provocation, dating back, counting many years, more recently, President Trump's fire and fury flying nuclear-armed bombers in North Korea. But that all came to nothing, because at the end of the day, not only does North Korea have nuclear arms, now it's got delivery systems. And then the North Koreans have just announced they have virtually completed their nuclear deterrence program. Now, apart from nuclear arms, let's not forget that there are hundreds of conventional cannons which are positioned within less than maybe 100 kilometers from Seoul. So within a number of hours, Seoul could be obliterated when this hundreds of cannons are fired with the proximity of Seoul to the North Korean borders. And these cannons are already there, and they're a long time. Now, not only that, for this so-called decapitation or preemptive strike to succeed, this must be predicated on China or even Russia doing nothing. But this is not the case, because China regards the North Korean as a stable ally, and then the scenario of obliterating North Korea from the map, resulting in American-controlled Korean Peninsula, would not act in China's best interest. So any kind of precipitating action by the United States or South Korea could backfire into a regional, if not a global war, involving China and the United States and other powers, including Russia. So I don't think that this is going to translate into a bomb or any kind of hot war. I think that it's just a saber rattling of a different kind in anticipation of the November midterm elections. And of course, President Biden is seeing his popularity rating continuing dropping, and his high chance of losing both the House and the Senate, and therefore becoming a lame duck president. So I think that he's got to be seen to be strong on China, Taiwan, and to North Korea.
Okay. And Jennifer, I wonder if the new South Korean president has clarified this, what his stance is regarding this denuclearization and the such talks and the concerns about North Korea. Is he speaking of any kind of dialogue or negotiation, encouraging the other side to sit at the negotiating table, or are you just thinking about conducting such drills that Pyongyang considers to be highly provocative?
Well, he says that he wants to dialogue with North Korea. He wants his administration's officials to dialogue with the North, and he offered an aid package similar to what previous South Korean presidents have offered. But he has not gone as far as his predecessor, Moon Jae-in, in engaging the North while offering such aid, because the previous Moon Jae-in administration did not engage in these types of war drills in the field involving Korea massive punishment retaliation, which is a name used by the South Koreans for this decapitation strike. And he was very careful only to do computer simulated drills. So this new president, Yoon Suk-yeol, although he may be offering the same amount of aid as, you know, President Moon Jae-in or former South Korean presidents, the difference is that he is engaging in an extremely provocative war games, which have not been happening here on the Korean Peninsula in 5 years. The former U.S. President Trump, he canceled those. And those were at the instigation of South Korean President Moon Jae-in. But this new president, Yoon Suk-yeol, as I said, is extremely hawkish toward the North, and he wants to use these drills to somehow pressure the North into denuclearizing. His goal is to fully denuclearize North Korea, and many experts say that's just not realistic, given how far North Korea's nuclear weapons program has developed now. They say he should settle for arms control agreements with the North and give up on trying to denuclearize the North. And the North has warned that the U.S. and South Korea are going to see an unprecedented level of provocations and security challenges, like a major missile test, a nuclear test, or even border skirmishes involving deaths and fatalities.
Okay, Andrew, given what the escalation that we're talking about, Jennifer is referring to that, you also said this is an escalation. So what's the way out of this? What's the prospect of peace and tranquility on the Korean Peninsula? What does it take to see calm restored?
It seems that the United States and South Korea unable to think outside the box. Let's not forget that all these negotiations and overtures combined with fine fury, six-party talks, they all ended up nothing because there is a lack of trust on both sides. The United States keep on asking the North Korean to give up everything before talking, and the North Korean regard the nuclear deterrence as their insurance policy. And they can't think outside the box to think that, well, let's think about the example of Vietnam. Vietnam was used a communist country against the United States. And then the Vietnam War did not change anything until the United States concentrated on the economy. Building an economy and helping the Vietnam has completely changed Vietnam. It's now Vietnam is more or less a United States ally. So I think that the United States is totally incapable of thinking outside the box. But having said that, though, I don't think that they can afford to do this. As I said, with the midterm elections coming up, the United States needs to be strong, antagonistic, North Korea. But that's not going to solve the problem.
Okay. Thanks for that. Jennifer Chang in Seoul, Andrew Leung in Hong Kong. Now moving on, another U.S. delegation is in Taiwan as tensions are running high with China following the controversial August 2nd visit by U.S. House of Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The governor of U.S. state of Indiana is in Taipei for the third time this month. Eric Holcomb held talks with Taiwanese president on what it called mutual strategic partnership. In a meeting, President Tsai Ing-wen slammed China's recent drills near her country. She called for support against what she called military threats from China. American delegations have been paying back-to-back visits to Taiwan over the past month. China considers Taiwan part of its territory, regards the visits as a challenge to its sovereignty. Beijing accuses Washington of threatening regional peace. It's conducted several military exercises near Taiwan. The Taliban government in Afghanistan has called on the UN Security Council not to use Western sanctions as a pressure tool against the country. Taliban Foreign Ministry spokesman warned about a stern response if travel bans on Afghan officials are not lifted in accordance with the Doha Agreement. Abdul Ghaffar Balkhi issued the warning in tweets ahead of a planned UN Security Council meeting on Monday. And that's all we have for you for this news bulletin. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha.
One day, the field of jihad is the military field, such as during the sacred defense and in defending the holy shrines. In such cases, the field is a military one. In those days, many individuals correctly understood their duty and carried it out. Of course, it was an obligation that required a number of people to do it. It was not compulsory for everyone to do it. In that field as well, the hay'ats carried out their duty in full, as I explained before. Many of our soldiers and our martyrs were members of hay'ats. And then one day, the field of jihad is a scientific field. In this field, one must work to improve the level of science in the country. And one day, the field of jihad includes social activities and public services for the people. That day is when the enemy is trying to exert economic pressures on society, thus pitting the people against Islam and the Islamic government. If you render economic and social services to the people at such a time, you're actually doing jihad to confront the enemy. However, the most important field is the field of clarification and enlightenment. If there is clarification, all these fields will become clear in the right circumstances, and the people will find their path on their own.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I have reliable information that today a multitude of media sources that cannot even be counted, especially due to the circumstances in the internet, are busy working using thousands of experts. These are experts in the arts, media and communication who are backed by substantial financial support and also support in terms of security. For what goal? They wish to turn around minds and opinions in the Islamic Republic and to weaken and destroy faith and belief. This is how things are. What plots are being devised for other countries is another discussion. The things that I am talking about are the schemes that are designed for our country, our people, our Islamic Republic and our beliefs. Thousands of institutions are working with huge amounts of money and various kinds of support. Well, this is a satanic move made by Shaitan's camp. What stands up to Shaitan's camp? The camp of struggle and jihad on the way of Allah. Well, you are the hay'ats. You should ask your own hay'at where it stands in this jihad.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Early on Thursday, the Israeli military has shot down seven Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. The military broke into the offices of the organizations and confiscated property. Palestinian's foreign ministry has censored the raids as an attempt to silence the voice of truth and justice, saying rights groups remain the prime target of the regime because they document its crimes against Palestinians. Six of the organizations raided had been criminalized as terrorist organizations in October 2021 by Israel, which claimed they were affiliated with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless. The organizations targeted on Thursday work in fields such as human rights, prisoner support, children's rights, and healthcare. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations by Israel, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bissan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees. Since 1967, Israel has banned more than 400 local and international organizations, including all major Palestinian political parties. Analysts speculate that Israel had attacked the groups because they were becoming increasingly effective at exposing Israel's repression of Palestinian people.
That their Achilles heel is their ongoing horrific violations of human rights, which are losing them support throughout the world. And so they're apparently thinking that they can kill the messenger and get rid of those who are reporting on their crimes just by shutting them down on spurious pretenses.
The Israeli army has deprived generations of Palestinians in the West Bank of their basic civil right, including the right to expression, regularly using military force to suppress Palestinian people. The latest raid on Palestinian non-governmental human rights organizations and their designation as terrorist organizations have been denounced by UN experts and were rejected by 9 European states that fund targeted groups. The European countries also called Israel's allegations against the NGOs unsubstantiated. Last year, Israel's leading human rights group, B'Tselem, said in a report that Israel is not a democracy but an apartheid regime that systematically oppresses the Palestinians via military occupation and racist laws, is using laws, practices, and organized violence to cement the supremacy of one group over another.
Israel is obviously trying to silence the voices of critics who've been documenting the ongoing abuses of human rights, the murders of children, shooting down teenagers, bombing targets, and killing all sorts of people, often at random. They're essentially ongoing massacres, not to mention the torture, which is a systematic feature of Israeli policy.
Israeli policies and practices toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories should be scrutinized, but only condemning Israeli raids on Palestinian civil society groups is not enough. It's high time the UN and international organizations took direct action against Israeli atrocities.
Tensions are rising between Turkey and Syria. Ankara has launched airstrikes on military posts in northern Syria, killing several army soldiers and injuring several more. There are now concerns that a military operation in northern Syria by Turkish forces is imminent. Sources say a new cross-border offensive by Turkey looms large. Turkish forces have reportedly used loudspeakers in mosques in border areas close to the Jarabulus city to ask people to stay indoors in preparation for the operation. Reports also say numerous Turkish combat drones could be seen flying in the skies over areas in proximity to the frontier. Turkish soldiers are also mobilizing in most of the border towns of Hasaka, Raqqa, and Aleppo provinces. The Turkish president has already hinted at a possible military incursion. On August 8th, Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Ankara's decision to establish a 30-kilometer deep secure line along the country's southern border is final. Ankara says it's going to curb Kurdish militants operating in that area.
They want actually to annex the northern part of Syria. This is an ambition that Turkey has to regain, to enlarge some territory that it once had. And I think this is not something that is acceptable either to Syria or even to Russia. Russia wants to have good relations with Turkey, but not at this price, I think.
The U.S.-backed Kurdish People's Protection Unit, or YPG, militant group, which is the backbone of SDF, is present there. Ankara says YPG militants are terrorists. Damascus has warned Ankara against violating its sovereignty. Both Iran and Russia, which have been aiding Damascus in its anti-terror campaign, are also against Turkey's possible offensive. Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019. Back then, Turkish forces launched a cross-border invasion to push YPG militants away. Since 2016, Turkey has launched three military operations inside Syria. When the crisis began on Syria in 2011, Ankara backed militants fighting against the government in Damascus. For years, it provided them with weapons and military support in a bid to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
So this is perhaps just a what we sometimes call a red herring, that is something that will distract the observers from what is actually going on. It makes it appear, makes Turkey appear to be reasonable, when in fact they don't have a reasonable agenda at all. They have an unreasonable agenda.
However, there are signs that Turkey may have changed its policy on Syria. Just recently, it was revealed that the Turkish foreign minister had a brief conversation with his Syrian counterpart last October. The top Turkish diplomat has stressed that there needs to be a reconciliation between opposition groups and the Damascus government. There are reports that Ankara was evaluating the possibility of starting talks with the Syrian government. The leader of Turkey's Nationalist Movement Party has also supported comments to mend relations with neighboring Syria. Turkey now appears to be in a difficult position. The country's economy is now in its worst situation in decades. It's spending nearly $2 billion in northern Syria annually. And sentiments against Syrian refugees in Turkey are rising. That could potentially cost Erdogan his political career. In order to fix it, Erdogan needs to establish relations with Syria.
I think it's going to be a major problem. The Turkish attack indicates that they are not going to accept a reasonable compromise and to respect the territorial integrity of Syria. So this is going to be a major problem.
But at the same time, Ankara does not want to lose Syria card with regards to anti-Assad militants. However, its possible military adventure in northern Syria could trigger another catastrophe in a country which is in the midst of a prolonged crisis.
Tensions are once again heating up between France and its former colony, Mali. The African nation has accused the European country of violating its territorial integrity and arming terrorists. Malian Foreign Ministry has written a letter to the head of the United Nations Security Council, urging the body to punish France over its interventionist policies in Mali. We have several pieces of evidence that these flagrant violations of Malian airspace were used by France to collect intelligence for terrorist groups operating in the Sahel and to drop arms and ammunition to them. Mali has called on the UN Security Council to ensure that France, quote, immediately ceases its acts of aggression. Mali has cited an attack on Tessit camp as evidence of the meddling of France in the African nation.
As to what gains France would have from arming the terrorist groups and operating across Mali, in northern Mali specifically, I think the French are very angry because they have been kicked out of Mali by the Malian authorities. And they are about to finish their evacuation, military bases evacuation from the country, if they have not finished already.
Mali says after the attack, which claimed the lives of 42 soldiers, quote, clandestine and uncoordinated overflight operations were conducted. Mali also says it reserves the right to use self-defense in the face of measures that undermine the stability of the African nation. France has, however, rejected the allegation, saying it's actually fighting the terrorists.
Essentially, the problem here is the French want to cling to the West African country in Mali and across the region, the Sahel region, for as long as possible. This is their traditional sphere for influence, and they would prefer to stay there.
The latest spat between Mali and France follows a barrage of accusations and counter-accusations between the two nations. France has apparently completed the withdrawal of its forces from Mali. The withdrawal has ended a 9-year operation in the country. France began its mission in Mali in 2013. The operation was aimed at eradicating militants that Paris claimed were linked to the Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. France deployed thousands of troops to purportedly prevent separatist forces from reaching Bamako. But the war proved disastrous for Mali and its people. The war caused several thousand deaths and more than 1 million people to flee their homes. Anti-France sentiments are running high among Malians amid the rising civilian death toll. People were long demanding the withdrawal of the troops of their former colonizer.
I think France, you know, because of its colonial history in West Africa, is not able to extricate itself voluntarily. What we've noticed over the last several months, there's been numerous demonstrations against French military presence in Mali and in other West African countries.
Mali fell under French colonial rule in 1892, which lasted until 1960. But years after outright colonization, it is still seeking to bring the countries in Africa under its colonial rule. It has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960. In economic terms, the former French colonies in West Africa are using a common currency that's controlled by the French treasury.
Well, Mali is very important. First of all, it was a French colony. Second of all, the French have maintained some kind of presence, military or otherwise, as well as political and diplomatic influence over the country right after its independence in the 1960s. And from Mali, they could do a lot of surveillance work, intelligence work, and military interference in other countries across the Sahara region, including southern Libya.
Critics say the currency channels more money to France and it strengthens its monetary policy on African nations. In order for that to change, experts say there needs to be a radical change from the past colonial policies.
China has slammed a visit to Taiwan by a group of American legislators, saying it has fully exposed Washington's true face as the spoiler of peace in the strategically sensitive Taiwan Strait. A U.S. congressional delegation, led by Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts, arrived in Taipei on Sunday and met with the island's president, Tsai Ing-wen, on an unannounced 2-day visit amid tensions between Beijing and Washington over a recent controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the self-ruled island. In a statement, China's defense ministry said that the U.S. lawmakers' trip is against Beijing's sovereignty and territorial integrity and fully exposes the true face of the United States as a spoiler and spoiler of peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. The ministry also vowed to smash any form of foreign interference in its domestic affairs. In response to the visit, China's defense ministry also carried out more exercises near Taiwan. The military says the exercises are a stern deterrent to the U.S. and its political games undermining regional peace. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry said the latest visit is a blatant violation of the One China principle.
China once again urges the U.S. to abide by the One China principle and the three Sino-U.S. joint communiques, handle Taiwan-related issues prudently and properly, and stop going further down the wrong path of hollowing out and distorting the One China principle so as not to cause further damage to China-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The spokesman added that a small number of U.S. politicians are colluding with Taiwan's separatist forces. He said they are unaware of their limits and their efforts are doomed to failure. The visit by Pelosi promoted Beijing to react with an unprecedented burst of military activity, launching its biggest ever military drills around Taiwan. China considers Taiwan to be a breakaway province that should be reunited with the motherland under the internationally recognized One China policy.
What we see is the U.S. trying to provoke tensions where they don't have to. What we have to keep in mind is since 1972, under the Shanghai Communique, the United States government has recognized that there is only one China. Taiwan is part of China. But what we see right now with these tensions being built up is the U.S. trying to manipulate international law and use the idea of American exceptionalism to say that it's trying to help Taiwan and it's not trying to provoke tensions between Taiwan and China.
Tensions between the U.S. and China simmer at a new high since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan earlier this month. Now, the U.S. President's Indo-Pacific coordinator, Kurt Campbell, has revealed that Washington will send aircraft and warships to the Taiwan Strait in the coming weeks, claiming the U.S. expects China to put more pressure on Taipei in the next few months. The senior White House official also stated that Washington is going to announce an ambitious roadmap for trade with Taiwan in the coming days. That's while China claims Taiwan as its own territory and has repeatedly warned against the island's growing ties with Washington. Tensions are high, and the bill moving through Congress threatens to overturn Sino-U.S. relations and could prompt a stronger response from Beijing. The Taiwan Policy Act aims to upgrade ties with the island by designating it as a major non-NATO ally. The Taiwan Policy Act of 2022 would also bolster Taiwan's defense capabilities with $4.5 billion in security aid.
I mean, what the U.S. is doing right now is trying to continue to impose U.S. hegemony in Asia, with the U.S. losing hegemony in places like Latin America. It is trying to stay relevant and maintain the relationships that it does have.
It's obvious that the U.S. is only continuing to elevate tensions with China, and Taiwan could end up being caught in the middle of a conflict.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
If our intellectuals could understand the socio-political objective of these prayers, morning sessions, and passion plays, they would not then question the holding of these gatherings of morning rituals. All intellectuals plus westernized people and all the power wielders put together cannot produce a 15th of Khordad, June 5th, uprising. The holder of such might is he, Imam al-Hussein, under whose banner all congregates. We who cry we want Islam and the Islamic Republic know that it is because all have come together under the banner, which is Islamic, and is for Allah, and they all rose, as we all saw, for Allah.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. We seek refuge from Satan the accursed, and in the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, we start another episode of the program, The Spring of Truth. Welcome to this program in which we try to reflect and contemplate and shed some light and paraphrase some of the sayings and valuable words of Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayh, who is the founder of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Today, I want to talk about one very important topic in life, which is God. He says, "Do not neglect God even for a moment. Neglecting the source of power, which is God, leads mankind to perdition and destruction." Well, I think this is the test that we're all having in life. The world with all its glitters and the nature of it, you know, which is a game, lahw and la'ib, which is mentioned in the Quran, which means like, you know, a game. And then the remembrance of God, like that this is the trial and the test of life. On the one hand, you have all the beautiful glitters, and then on the other hand, you have God. So remembering that we are God-like and we have the potential to become perfect, but the hard part is remembering our source, where we came from and where we're heading.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi.
So in the Noble Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala beautifully mentions this fact by saying, "So celebrate the name of your Lord. وَذْكُرْ اسْمَ رَبَّكَ وَتَبَتَّلْ إِلَيْهِ تَبْتِيلًا." This is in chapter Muzammil, verse number 8, where he says, "Celebrate the name of your Lord. Constantly remember and mention highly the name of your Lord, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and dedicate yourself, dedicate your life, dedicate your being, dedicate all the cells of your body to Him with total dedication," which is something totally hard. And that is the secret to becoming a real human being. Elsewhere in the Quran, in chapter A'raf, verse number 205, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Remember your Lord within your heart beseechingly and reverentially, without being loud, morning and evening. And do not be among the heedless." So this is, I think, the secret to life. Thank you very much for being with us. And wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will look at the 1 year since the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan, the botched exit of U.S.-led allied forces, and the humanitarian crisis unfolding in the country. And we shall also discuss how India and Pakistan fare 75 years after their independence from British colonialism, also the challenges and opportunities facing them.
This week, last year, the Taliban laid siege to Kabul after dramatic advances across the country, overthrowing the West-backed government and forcing Americans to beat a hasty retreat. It came almost 2 decades after the US and its allies carpet-bombed Afghanistan on the pretext of decimating the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and capturing Osama bin Laden. The events leading up to the Taliban's comeback and the botched exit of foreign forces showed why and how the Hindu Kush country has been the graveyard of powerful empires.
Taliban staged a stunning comeback on August 15, 2021, toppling the West-backed government led by Ashraf Ghani and forcing the U.S. and its allies to abandon the South Asian country after years of futile military adventure. For 2 decades, the war in Afghanistan remained an enigma for the successive U.S. governments, from George Bush to Joe Biden, finally ending in a botched exit. It all started on February 29, 2022, when then-U.S. President Donald Trump's administration signed an agreement with the Taliban to pull out U.S. troops from the country by May 1, 2021. The deal, however, failed to de-escalate tensions between the two sides. On April 14, 2021, President Joe Biden announced that the remaining 2,500 to 3,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan would withdraw by September 11 to end what he called America's forever war. Between May and August 2021, the Taliban overran several key provincial capitals, with the beleaguered Afghan forces offering little resistance. On August 15, 2021, the Taliban finally marched into Kabul without firing a single bullet as the U.S.-backed government officials fled the country. A day after, thousands of panic-stricken people flocked to the Kabul airport, desperately looking for evacuation flights. The disastrous war ended the way it started, in a violent, disorderly, and reckless fashion.
The Taliban takeover and the hasty U.S. withdrawal spawned the worst humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan, especially after the U.S. froze the country's assets worth $9 billion U.S. dollars and halted billions in development aid. According to the United Nations, almost half of the country's population is today battling with acute hunger, including a large number of children. To rub salt on the wounds of Afghans, President Biden distributed their assets as compensation to the victims of the 9/11 attacks, drawing anger and outrage